Taking a look now at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Happy to have you listening in. And Dr. Sandy, happy to welcome you back.
Oh, it's such a beautiful day to be here.
Great day across Wisconsin. If you'd like to join in, have a question for Dr. Sandy, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us as well at talk@wpr.org. And let's start by talking a little bit about distemper. That's been in the news.
The reason why I'm bringing this up is it's one of those funny things that veterinarians get to deal with frequently. And I was talking to a student about this, and she had never heard this happen before. But I think the majority of the public has a misconception that distemper virus has something to do with the temperament of the dog.
Oh.
And so we had a dog in the other day, and the owner said, you know what, I think he's due for his vaccine because he's getting a little unruly. Absolutely nothing to do with temperament, okay? It's a virus that can affect the nervous system and cause seizures and death, mm-hmm. But also affects the nasal passages and the gastrointestinal tract and so on. And it is a fatal virus for many dogs that can contract it. That's why it's important to vaccinate for it. And I have not seen a case for a long time, but it's still quite prevalent in some parts of the country, primarily in big cities, like if you're in Chicago with the shelters and things there. So, if you're traveling with your pet, just because you're maybe in a location that it's not a big deal, you want to make sure that they're kept current on their vaccines.
Well, Diane in Mercer has a question for you, so let's go there.
Okay.
Hi, Diane. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a very active dog that sliced her toe. And she's used to going 6 miles a day. And I've been bandaging it and putting Neosporin on it and soaking it in soapy water. And it looks good. Mm-hmm. It's not pussy or anything, and it's pinky red.
Yeah.
Should it be wrapped or should it be in the air?
Well, that's a really good question because, if you put a bandage on an extremity, you have to make sure that it's on tight enough that it stays on. And dogs are Houdinis with getting them off, but you don't want to have it on so tight that you disrupt the blood flow to the toes. You also want to make sure that you keep it dry. There's nothing worse than a wet bandage on a wound. So this morning I got up and the grass was dewy. And so what do you do if you've got a dog with a bandaged foot? You have to put a plastic bag over it and it can be sometimes a management problem. What has your veterinarian said? Is this something that you have had checked by your veterinarian, or has it been just managed at home?
I have been managing it at home.
Okay.
I didn't know what they could do more for it.
Yeah. Sometimes, lacerations of pads, especially if it's one of the pad tissue, can be really difficult to deal with because it's so spongy. Every time the dog puts weight down on it, it will just rip any sutures out. So usually those we just let granulate in, which is keeping it protected, limiting, weight-bearing activity on it if you can, so no long walks or anything, until it's, totally healed. So without actually seeing the wound, I'm hard-pressed to say keep it open or whatever, but you don't want the dog to lick at it. That's an old wives' tale about a dog licking a wound is going to make it heal faster. They have so much bacteria in their mouth that it's just going to get it infected and can delay healing. So, I have a hard time, like I said, answering your question, and I think it's, it can go either way. But if you do put a bandage on, keep it dry, make sure that it doesn't fall off and it's not too tight, and change it frequently, like maybe every 48 hours. Yeah.
Okay. There you have it.
Can the vet speed the healing up?
It can if it prevents the dog from licking at it and prevents the outside world from getting in. It depends on how deep the laceration is. And so if it's, very superficial, you could probably leave it open. But if it's a deep one that maybe even needed stitches, then, keeping it covered and protected is going to probably help it a little bit better.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Kristen in Cottage Grove, we're on to you now. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
Hi. I had a question about some costs of veterinary care for cats.
Okay.
I volunteer for Angel's Wish in the Madison area, and they assist mostly homeless cats in finding new homes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually going to be participating with PetFinder.com tomorrow, Wednesday, all across the country, is Adopt a Less Adoptable Pet Day.
Okay. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. Yeah.
So they, you know, they're focusing on, in, you know, our situation, cats who are a little bit older. They might be senior cats. There are a couple of FIV-positive cats.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of concerns that people have when they adopt a cat, like with a special medical need or a senior cat, is the costs for mm-hmm. taking care of the cat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, also about being FIV positive, I know that they say that FIV positive cats should only live with other FIV positive cats.
Or by themselves, right?
But, you know, kind of wondering about, you know, does that necessarily shorten their lifespan? How much does it cost to care for an FIV-positive cat? Are there additional costs involved?
Yeah,
and then also,
yeah.
you know, senior cats, if it's a cat, say, over 10 years old.
Okay. Okay. Well, you brought up some very good points. One thing that I would recommend that your organization may want to, if you want to promote care of senior cats, is the American Animal Hospital Association. And you can just Google it or whatever. American Animal Hospital Association mm-hmm. has recently published senior cat care guidelines. And these are a committee gets together and sits down and they pull in all the research data as to, you know, what's the best, you know, things to do for older cats, not only nutrition and vaccines, but, you know, behavior management and how often to check blood pressure and blood work and all those things. So, you know, if it's a healthy senior cat, I mean, it all depends. Senior is relative. I mean, I see some cats that come in. I have a 22-year-old senior, very senior Siamese cat that's just trucking, not personally, but as a patient, that's trucking along and doing fine. And we just see him every 6 months and he's happy as can be. And, you know, there's various degrees of health issues. Your question regarding, you know, FIV positive cats, FIV, feline immunodeficiency virus, is in the same class of viruses as HIV. And it is primarily transmitted by cat to cat contact through fighting. It tends to be more of a street cat disease, or, you know, if these were cats that were living in a barn or out on the street and getting into fights, they probably picked it up that way. You're right in that they should go into homes that don't have other cats, or if they have another cat that is also FIV positive, because it's not fair to the existing cats.
Sure.
There is an FIV vaccine available that is, you know, questionable efficacy, and the big problem with it, it doesn't work for cats that already have FIV, may help cats that don't have it to prevent them from getting it, but they will always test positive. So then there's this big dilemma down the road of, you know, if they get sick for some other reason, do they have FIV or don't they? And so there's a lot of controversy about using that vaccine. In fact, the AHA guidelines will, not the senior care, but the vaccine guidelines address this as well regarding vaccine. What's involved with caring for a cat with FIV, they can live a long time with it as long as they're kept away from other cats, they're inside, they're not exposed to diseases, they're not boarded, on a good plane of nutrition. Usually what we will be monitoring is blood cell counts, depending on what we find, maybe annually to every 6 months if we're starting to pick up some abnormalities, or sometimes even more frequently. Be watching for things like, because they're immunocompromised, you have to keep their teeth nice and clean. So if an owner's willing to brush their teeth or have periodic dentals done, that's going to be helpful as well. So these are not inexpensive cats to keep, but they can lead a very long life and be quite happy for a long, long period of time. And, you know, I would rather see a cat have a life, even if it's just for a few years until problems start to arise, than have its life ended prematurely. And so if someone's going to adopt it and say, well, I can give them a home, but, you know, if things start to get really expensive, I may not be able to deal with it. You know, if the alternative is ending their life, you know, let them have a home for as long as they can. And you never know. Once someone gets really attached to a cat, they might decide to cough up some dough down the road. So, but, you know, giving you an idea of what it costs, boy, I mean, every clinic's going to be a little bit different. But, you know, senior cats, you're probably looking at, I would guess, minimum for some blood work, urinalysis, you know, vaccines and so on, probably a couple $100 a year would be a rough estimate that I'd be looking at for a healthy senior cat.
Okay, so $15 maybe a month or something, something like that. Mm-hmm. And what's the website address again, Kristen?
It's angelswish.org.
Angelswish.org.
Right.
And tomorrow's the big day.
Tomorrow's the big day.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I hope we get lots of these kitties adopted, and they do make great pets.
Thank you very much for calling, Kristen. Along the line of cost, we have an email from Susan, who had the vet had charged of her for Revolution, something called Revolution. She found a site. This is for two kitties.
Mm-hmm.
She found a site that was almost $40 cheaper. It sounded like a local purveyor, Joe's Pet Meds. It turns out the place was in Australia.
Yeah.
The product I received appears to be the same stuff I bought in the States. Should I worry?
Yes. And that's one of the problems. There's very little regulation about online pet pharmacies. And, you know, there were reports, and I haven't seen anything recently of, you know, owners not getting the medication that they should have. So if you are going to be dealing with an online pharmacy, it should be one that is, you know, in this country and large, reputable, and talk to your veterinarian about that. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, promote online pharmacies on this show and give actual names. But if someone came up to me and said, you know, what about this pharmacy? What do you know about them? You know, I'd be able to say, you know, that's one that is, you know, a fairly reputable company. And, you know, the reason why there's sometimes a cost difference between, you know, online pharmacies and veterinary clinics is just the volume that they're able to do. And it's, you know, it is hurting veterinarians because it is something that, you know, we are, you know, having to compete. And I know we've changed a lot of our prices to be able to compete with online pharmacies as well. So talk to your vet about this and I'd be, you know, a little careful about using it.
Okay. Here's another email from Kathy. If you have a cat that's kept strictly indoors with no contact with other pets or other animals, what are the minimal requirements as far as immunizations go and which routine health exams are needed?
Good question. And again, back to that website, the American Association of Feline Practitioners and AHA have websites regarding vaccine schedules for cats. What I would be recommending for a strictly indoor, healthy, young cat is once they've gone through their series of vaccines as a kitten and then maybe a year later, for the upper respiratory vaccination component, the guidelines are to give that every 3 years. So that would be rhinotracheitis, Khaleesi, and panleukopenia or cat distemper, which is very different than dog distemper. And that is the guidelines that are published nationally is to do that every 3 years. In high-risk cats, cats that are boarded, going to cat shows, living with cats with upper respiratory disease, your veterinarian may recommend it be given more frequently. But for your average cat, every 3 years. Remember, rabies is the law. There, although it's not a state law, it is local ordinance. And I've had some horror stories of strictly indoor cats, not current on rabies vaccine, biting someone. Maybe they got their tail stuck in the door, or got stepped on, and out of defense bit somebody. If you can't show proof of rabies, your cat may be forced to go through quarantine. And that's not very much fun because they have to get taken away from you and spend 10 days, you know, in a veterinary clinic or a facility that is able to do quarantine. Have had stories of, in fact, one of my own clients had a bat get into their home and their unvaccinated cat was found playing with this bat. It was tested and it was positive for rabies. So the cat had to go through 6 months of quarantine. Owners had to be vaccinated. It was a mess. So even indoor cats need to be vaccinated for rabies. And it really depends on your local ordinance. There are one-year vaccines. There are three-year vaccines out there. The one-year vaccine that we recommend for cats is a little bit safer for cats and less irritating and less chance of local reaction. So that's the one that I recommend.
Let's turn to Jim in Green Bay next. Jim, hello to you.
Hey, Dr. Sandy. Nice to talk with you.
Hi.
I've got a one-year-old Sheltie female, a beautiful, loving, sweet dog. The problem we have is we can't really take her anywhere because she gets sick in the car and she drools so much that you can't think a 11-pound dog would have that much water.
Oh, my goodness. So these are even for short trips she is drooling and carrying on like this.
Oh, yeah. We tried just, like, you know, maybe driving around the block to get her used to it, and she just drools up a storm, and she throws up. It's just like, oh, you poor thing.
Motion sickness. Yeah, yeah. You know, some of this may be, you know, just stress-related. It may be motion sickness. Things that I always recommend people to try before we start jumping into using medical management is if she gets in the car willingly and is really happy to, you know, get in the car but then get sick, try changing how she's housed in the car, either, you know, having her in a crate, facing in a different direction so she can't see the world going by. Sometimes that helps, having her in, like, towards the center of the car, you know, in the center of the back seat, something like that, or maybe in the center up front. That helps sometimes, just changing the location of where she is.
Okay.
You know, if she's nervous about getting in the car, then, you know, backing up a little bit, and it may just be that you'll have to have all the car doors open and, you know, throw ball into the car. She jumps in, gets it, gets out again. You know, sit in the car, you give her treats, you make it lots of fun, you turn the engine on, you're making it fun for her in the car, and gradually, you know, step by step by step, get to the point where you put the car in gear, but you don't move. And then you put the car in gear and you back up a little bit, and stop, you know, get out of the car. So she gradually gets used to it rather than just jumping into going around the block. But if she is that nauseated, there's a new drug. Well, it's been on the market now for a couple of years, that's called Serenia. And it is an oral anti-nausea tablet that is not sedating. Some of the other drugs that we would use before were actually sedatives that calm the dog down as well as stop the vomiting, primarily a drug called acepromazine. But now with having this drug called Serenia, we can have a dog that can go through training and not be nauseated, and you can, you know, kind of stop that drooling and vomiting cycle and maybe get her to the point where she really likes going in the car, too. So talk to your veterinarian about using that.
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Our guest today, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in, or maybe just have a question about pets in general. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. And Sandy, we have an email from David who says, my cat needs to have his teeth cleaned, but the estimates to have it done could be as much as $750, which seems a bit steep. I'd like to have it taken care of, but not for that price. He's also very vet aversive to the point that it's traumatic for him, and the procedure is pretty invasive.
Yeah.
Anything I can do at home to clean his teeth using a high-quality kibble that says it helps brush his teeth? Is the above price, $750, is that typical? Should I shop around for a better price?
Yeah, you really have to look at what's involved with doing a dentistry. First of all, if it involves a general anesthetic, cats are not going to sit still while you go in and start probing around in their mouth, or, you know, putting an ultrasonic scaler in there and cleaning teeth and polishing like we would. You know, it does require anesthesia, depending on the age of the cat. And most cats that are requiring dentistry are probably older kitties. They need to have some pre-anesthetic lab work done, so that adds to the expense as well. We don't want to anesthetize a kitty that is going to have some health risks, that they've got underlying kidney disease or anything like that. Also, one thing to be looking at is, are radiographs or x-rays being taken of your cat's teeth? Common problem that cats get are this condition called FORLs, feline odontoclastic resorptive lesions. They're kind of like a cat version of cavities, very different than human cavities, but they may be hard to see in the mouth unless you take an x-ray and start looking at, you know, are we getting these erosive lesions occurring right around the neck of the tooth or into the root structure. Those can be very painful and may need to be extracted. And again, when you start extracting these teeth, you may be looking at oral surgery. You can't just pull them. You need to sometimes take, you know, incise gum tissue, remove some bone and so on. And it requires some stitches and, you know, work that way. So, you know, cats aren't going in like we are every 6 months where we're, you know, keeping things, you know, on an even keel. Most people are leaving it until the point where the cat does have pretty significant periodontal disease. And that's where this expense comes in. Radiographs, oral surgery, you know, the cleaning is a minor part of what's involved with dental care for cats that are in need of it. What you can do at home, if your kitty has a painful mouth, feeding them a dental diet may not be the most humane thing. They tend to be larger kibble that the cat needs to chew to be able to swallow it, that keep the teeth clean by squeegeeing the teeth clean with their unique fiber matrix in the middle. So, you know, don't switch to something like that unless you know that your cat is not painful in the, its oral cavity. If you can brush your cat's teeth, by all means do that. Most cats don't see the humor in it, and especially if the mouth hurts. Putting a toothbrush in there may not be the most comfortable thing, but once the teeth are taken care of, the painful teeth are removed, then you can start doing these kind of things. So 750 sounds like a lot, but when you look at what's involved, it's a major procedure, even though it sounds like, you know, just teeth. It's not just teeth.
Jay in Holman, it is your turn. Hi, Jay.
Oh, I have a 15-month English setter that is starting to lick his front elbows and back hips and sort of getting the start of lick granulomas. I had English about 30 years ago that was plagued by this for a year, and these are just barely pink, and there's still hair on the spots, but I'm very concerned, and I'd like your recommendation.
Yeah, you know, whenever I have a dog, especially multiple spots that they're licking over joint areas, I wonder if it's not something that is bothering the dog, whether they've got some joint pain. And that's, you know, like, if, you know, if your elbow hurts, what do? We reach our other hand around. I'm rubbing it right now, rubbing my elbow, you know. Dogs can't do that. They don't have hands that they can touch themselves with, so they use their mouth. So make sure that there isn't some underlying medical reason that your dog is starting to do some licking like that. Dogs that get these things called lick granulomas, sometimes they are there for behavior reasons. If they're bored, if they're anxious, they may start self-mutilating, picking a spot and licking or chewing at themselves. Sometimes it's a result of, you know, if they've had a spot that's been shaved or irritated, had an injection given, they may, you know, start licking at that. And then once they lick, it continues on to be a habit. They get a deep-seated infection, and it can be a real pain to get under control. If it's early, you can try, and you've ruled out medical reasons why your dog may, or surgical or orthopedic reasons why your dog may be licking, then you can try some of the things that stop dogs from licking. One of my favorite products on the market is called Yuck, Y-U-K exclamation point. Absolutely horrible tasting. You apply it a couple times a day, and that may prevent your dog from licking, but they may just move to another spot if it is a behavior problem. So not just a, you know, a simple thing, put this on the joint and your dog's going to be fine. I think you need to probably visit with a veterinarian and try to get to the bottom of it.
Okay. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it, Jay. Anita in Delavan, we're on to you now. Hi, Anita.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I rescued a two-year-old Westie in 06, and periodically she has been vomiting bile.
Okay.
I've taken her to my vet, and they've ruled out, is it Addison's or Addington's disease?
Addison's, yeah.
And I've switched dog foods, and I've recently tried making my own dog food.
Okay.
Dr. Michael Fox's homemade natural dog food.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
I'm not, but yeah.
Okay. Yep. And...
when is she doing this vomiting? Is
well,
any time, a particular time of day that
it
happens?
No, like once a week.
Okay.
Or so, once every 10 days or
okay.
so.
Okay. And is it usually like in the morning before a meal or after she...
It can be any time.
Any time. Okay.
It can be any time.
And there's never food or anything else associated with it?
No.
Okay.
Well, my vet says it's stress.
Yeah. When we see dogs that do this, one of the more common reasons, and you always want to rule out, is there something else going on? It sounds like your veterinarian did some blood work.
Yes.
You know, you may want to go through a therapeutic treatment for parasites. There is a parasite that lives in the stomach called Physalopteria that can cause intermittent vomiting. And they can be very hard to diagnose. You don't find them easily on a routine stool check. Sometimes we just go ahead and treat them with a medication that, as a, you know, just assuming that they may be there. So hopefully your veterinarian's gone through all of this.
Well, I've taken in stool samples.
Okay, but you may not find them because they you have to do a very different type of stool check to be able to diagnose these. You have to do what's a test called a Behrman test, but even then you may not even pick it up. So it's, you know, sometimes we just do response to therapy. So you know, having your dog treated appropriately for this parasite called Physalopteria. We do have it in this area. It's spread by dogs eating beetles and bugs and things like that that act as the intermediate host. But there is a common problem that occurs in a lot of dogs that is called bilious vomiting syndrome. When, you know, if you've ever had reflux, you know how kind of you reflux up into your esophagus, you get heartburn and you feel horrible. Well, dogs will tend to reflux from their small intestine into their stomach. And so some of this bile like material that doesn't belong in the stomach, that belongs in the intestinal tract, gets into the stomach. They start to feel nauseated, it's irritating, and up it comes. It's usually associated with having an empty tummy, and, you know, so not eating recently. And after they've been laying down and relaxed for in a, you know, certain position for a while, kind of like humans that get reflux. If you, you know, lay in a certain position, you may have problems, and it's just because you've got maybe a weaker sphincter or something like that going on. So what I would recommend for if you've, you know, ruled out everything before you start jumping into, you know, other diagnostics like ultrasound, scoping, biopsies, all that stuff to be able to look in the stomach, I would be looking at feeding your dog maybe instead of if you're doing it just once a day, 2 to 3 times a day, making sure that your dog is getting a little bit of food before going to bed so that they have food in their tummy. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about using a drug called metoclopramide, or what that is it's a drug that helps the motility. It gets everything moving out of the stomach and into the intestinal tract and helps tighten up those sphincters a little bit. Some dogs do better on that. I'll also put some of these dogs on just something like Pepcid AC.
Yeah, she's on a half a tablet every twice a day.
Yeah, and sometimes that helps as a an antacid type thing. But this is not an acid issue. It's more of a reflux from the small intestine up into the stomach. So talk to your veterinarian about, you know, treatment for bilious vomiting. But try the multiple little meals a day, and especially before going to bed. And if she does this, if you can get something into her tummy right away, like a cracker or a little bit of food, sometimes even just a little rice or whatever, just something bland will give her some stomach something to work on, and they usually bounce right back from this.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Marilyn in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. I was concerned because my ferret, it seems like he's losing the hair on his tail.
Oh, yeah.
I think it might be because he seems to be biting it a lot. Maybe his skin is irritated. I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, the most common reason why ferrets start to get that rat tail appearance and are itchier than normal is because they have ferret adrenal gland disease. The adrenal glands are, for ferrets, they can develop these overactive adrenal glands, and that's what you'll see is them being kind of twitchy and a little more irritated, as well as hair loss. It starts on the tail and eventually spreads up over the body. This would be something that when you go in for your evaluations, physical exams, and ferrets need to be looked at a little more frequently than most dogs and cats. They, you know, any ferret like over 2 years of age, I recommend that they come in every 6 months to be looked at. What your veterinarian would probably be recommending is having this, you know, maybe an ultrasound done to see if there's a adrenal gland that they can operate on. This is something that they sometimes do surgery on. There's another drug that's used sometimes called Lupron that helps these ferrets too. Some of them will do better with melatonin, but that's a little controversial. But, you know, this is a common ferret problem. Do a little online search about ferret adrenal gland disease, and I think you'll find out just how many ferrets actually have this.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And Corey in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Corey.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
I have adopted a cat from a foster, from an agency, and he is FIV positive.
Okay.
He's about 11 years old, I guess. I do have other cats, and I just would like to know basically what sort of precautions I have to take. I understand that the FIV can only be passed through the blood, I believe, but if you could be more specific about what kind of precautions I should take.
Well, I like to call FIV the kind of the angry cat disease. Feline leukemia, we call it the friendly cat transmission. Feline leukemia can be transmitted through just mutual grooming, sharing litter boxes, food bowls, and so on. FIV doesn't tend to be transmitted that way. It's transmitted primarily through fighting and biting, which is why for many cats it tends to be a male, because more boy cats fight, but a male street cat disease. Females can get it too. It's not, you know, it's not going to discriminate against sex at all. But so the fact that you've got other cats in your home, what I would be recommending is make sure that there is no fighting at all, because your other cats would have a chance of picking this up if they're fighting and actually biting each other. I would talk to your veterinarian about vaccinating your existing cats, having them tested to make sure that they are negative, and then vaccinating them. Again, the vaccine's a little controversial, but I think that that's going to be your best bet at trying to keep your cats healthy.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Chris emailed us and says our golden doodle gets what we think is hay fever, starts about mid-August and lasts through a hard frost. We've tried antihistamines with no obvious success. Mainly he itches and scratches and is kind of in danger of scratching to the point of infection. Mm-hmm. Any advice?
Well, welcome to the world of, you know, mixed breed dogs. Golden doodles are one of those hot designer dogs that are out there. And unfortunately, it sounds like your dog's probably got a little more golden than poodle in it. Goldens, I like to refer to golden retrievers as the kind of the spokes dog for dogs with allergies. It's very common in the breed. And you're very observant to see that it is seasonal. So that tells me it's probably something in the environment, pollens, mold, something like that, that's triggering this. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about a number of other approaches besides using antihistamines. They tend to not work that well. If your dog is to the point where the skin is getting raw and irritated, there likely is a secondary infection, a yeast infection, a bacterial infection. So get those off the table and ruled out and treated if appropriate, or if needed. Other things that you'd want to be talking to your veterinarian about is topical things that may help keep the itching under control, like topical steroid sprays, topical ear drops if the ears are inflamed. There's one that we use on the feet called TCA spray, triamcinolone spray. Goes by the name of Genesis, and so your veterinarian may be able to prescribe that for your dog. Sometimes adding in a balanced fatty acid supplement. And it's not just a matter of putting oil on your pet's food. It's using actually the right levels of EPA and DHA and all these things. And again, your veterinarian would be able to recommend a product that would fit your dog's needs. Other things that we'll do is I'm a big believer in a drug called cyclosporine. There's a company that makes it, and it goes by the name of Atopica. You may want to check that out online and talk to your veterinarian about having your dog started on cyclosporine. It really helps these dogs. It's a immune modulating drug, and it can be a little pricey for big dogs, but it really does give them comfort and gets them through the season. And you can use it during the season and then stop. It doesn't necessarily have to be a year-round thing for your dog if it's just a seasonal problem. So talk to your veterinarian about that.
Nancy emailed us, and she says, I have a cat, Luna, who is allergic to many foods, is on a special diet. Her eyes water lots, and the third eye almost covers one eye because of this. She seems limited in her ability to see. Nothing showed up on tests at the UW. What can I do for her? I have also tried using special detergents in case that was an issue. She's an indoor cat.
Wow. Well, usually cats, you know, they don't have eye issues when they have allergies. They may scratch their face and neck and sometimes secondarily traumatize their eye. I'd be more concerned about Nancy's cat having a problem with either a chronic herpes problem that can affect the eye and cause conjunctivitis and sometimes corneal ulcers and trauma that way. Not sure when you had your cat in to be checked. But if, you know, the third eyelid being up and, you know, the cat's vision is being that significantly impaired, maybe time to be coming back in for a recheck. And again, I'm not sure which department you were in, whether you came in through ophthalmology or dermatology, but a visit to a veterinary ophthalmologist may be in order as well. Sometimes there are medications and things that we can use to make the eye feel a lot more comfortable. The third eyelid happens to be one of those structures that it doesn't have its own nervous system to be able to control. It's not something that the cat can you know, flip up and down on its own. It's basically if the eyeball is pulled back in the socket because it's painful, the third eyelid just involuntarily comes up and covers the eye like a big windshield wiper. So sometimes we have to look for causes of discomfort, and dealing with those may help your cat be able to see a little bit better.
All right, let's go to Lou in Kenosha next. Lou, hello.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Hi, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
I'm so glad you're on today because I have a 20-pound schnauzer
who's okay.
going to be 10 years old. And last year he started with excessive panting and things like that. It was about this time of year, a little bit earlier. At the same time, I noticed he seemed to be a lot more hungry. So those two things went together.
Okay.
The vet did find a little bit of arthritis in his back, and that seemed to be under control pretty well. But the panting over time has gotten a lot worse.
Okay.
I had him to the vet just last week, and she said it's just too inspecific. He still got the arthritis, which he takes medication for.
Uh-huh.
But when I came home, I started thinking about the dog food.
Uh-huh.
The food he's always loved, Beneful Light.
Okay.
He loves vegetables. And so I decided I was just going to cook him up a mess of stuff with whole grains and a lot of vegetables and a little meat broth and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I began feeding him with that kind of thing, and the panting relented
okay.
quite a bit. And and so now right now he just came back from getting his hair cut, getting a ride in the car,
yeah.
you know, and was all excited, ate his food, and now he's laying there, just the ordinary little bit of panting that
yeah.
dogs will do in this.
Well, remember what panting is, one of those things that dogs do for a number of reasons. Sometimes dogs that are hot. That's the only way, besides sweating through their pads of their feet,
yes,
that
yes.
they get rid of extra body heat. So when it's a hot, humid day, especially if a pet has a heavy hair coat or is overweight, I don't know if your dog has a weight issue.
He's yeah. a little bit under 20 pounds. He's
yeah.
a miniature schnauzer.
I've seen some small schnauzers that probably 20 pounds would be too much for them. So ask your veterinarian to do a body condition score and actually tell you, I mean, and again, the owner's perception of what is a normal dog compared to a veterinarian's perception can be very different. You know, what I think of is an obese dog, a lot of owners think of as being normal, but, you know, may not be. And, you know, so dogs will pant because they can't get rid of body heat easily. They'll pant when they're stressed or anxious. Sometimes there are medical reasons why pets will pant as well, such as painful conditions, joint pain. They, you know, something's bothering them or hurting, and so they'll breathe faster and sometimes pant. There are some other medical conditions that can make them pant, and as well, we'll see sometimes dogs with Cushing's disease or other problems. There's a type of cancer called a pheochromocytoma that they'll sometimes pant with. It's kind of a rare thing, but they're, you know, and so going in for a good physical blood work to make sure that there's nothing medically wrong with your dog, and that would even include having a urine sample checked, especially being a schnauzer, they're prone to bladder stones and all kinds of things that way. That would be something I'd be looking into is if he hasn't had a good senior workup done, get that done, have his chest listened to, make sure that his heart is normal, that his lungs sound normal, that there's nothing medically wrong with him. I don't know why a diet change would cause your dog to stop panting. This would not be something that panting would not be related to, you know, a food allergy. It may just be that you had your dog on a more highly digestible diet, and instead of the food sitting in the stomach and being uncomfortable, that it maybe is going through a little bit faster. But really make sure that you are making a diet that is appropriate for your dog. I've got a list here. It's a little bit more to get into, but it's of things, and I would be more than willing to, you know, fax something to anybody that wants to see this article. It's on recommending homemade foods and what you should be looking for. It's a great little article for owners to follow. So, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation as we talk about your pet's health, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Luann from Minnesota emailed us. She says she's wondering why her cat is inconsistent when using her two litter boxes for pooping. Sometimes she uses the boxes, or she'll use an old piece of carpet that sits under the treadmill. This piece of carpet is the only area that she will use when not using her litter boxes. I've already replaced the litter boxes with new ones and replaced the piece of carpet with a new one, and she still goes there at times.
Yes, and one of the things that we get concerned about when we've got a cat defecating out of the box, this person didn't tell me the age of their cat, but you need to, again, I sound like a broken record, rule out medical reasons, such as impacted anal glands, constipation, lower back pain, you know, that type of thing, because many cases of cats that are defecating out of the box have an underlying medical problem that then they start associating the litter box equals pain, or I can get really good footing here on this piece of carpet, so I'm going to use this as my spot to go. For older cats, making sure that it's a low profile litter box that they can get in and out of, not a lot of litter in the box where they're going to sink in and maybe be a little unstable. If you know, cats do have arthritis and the litter boxes are in a location that are it's hard to reach, like down in the basement, they may start picking easier spots for eliminating that are, you know, are close to where they're sleeping. And so providing extra litter boxes is really important. She also didn't say how many cats she had. With one cat, two litter boxes
yep,
would be minimum.
Two.
And she has two cats. Okay.
No, she
has
two
litter boxes. We don't know how many cats she has, though. So if she had two cats, I'd want at least three litter boxes. We always add one more than cat number. And it can be, you know, a little bit of a problem if you've got a house full of cats. You know, I have three cats at home, and I have four litter boxes, but one of them is out in a garage. So it's kind of inaccessible, but and I have no problems. But boy, if I did, that'd be the first thing I would do is follow my own rules and add in an extra litter box. Should be one on every floor of the house. And if she's picked this area with the carpet to go in, she may like that location for whatever reason. I'd consider putting a litter box right in that area as well.
All right. Let's go to Candace in Nina next. Candace, hi.
Hi. Thanks for talking with me.
Sure.
I had 3 weeks ago, my 3-year-old Cavalier King Charles Spaniel stopped eating, and which was very odd for him. So the next day we took him to the vet, and they couldn't really find anything. They did a barium swallow to see if he had a bowel obstruction, and he didn't. And so then he still wouldn't eat. This was like on a Tuesday, and by Friday he still wasn't eating. We took him into our referral center, and they did an ultrasound that showed that his organs were, everything looked good except his pancreas was kind of thick and thick looking,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so they put him on IV fluids. And he was on the IV fluids from Friday till Tuesday, and he just kept getting worse and worse. And then on Tuesday, well, they tried some steroids then to try to perk him up. Anyway, he was suffering, so we had him put to sleep.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
On Tuesday, yeah, it's been just horrible. But I guess my question is, you know, he was 3 years old. He was thin. He didn't eat any junk, you know. We didn't feed him bad things. He's never off a leash, so he didn't get into anything.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see this very often in young dogs?
You know, there's lots of reasons why pets get sick, and I don't know what happened. I think that the fact that they found that maybe he was suffering from pancreatitis, that can be a horrible thing to have to go through. It's you know, it painful and
terrible.
Yeah.
He got like ascites where his abdomen was just full of fluids, and he had bruises all over him.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a nightmare, and I keep running it over through my mind if something else could have been done or if this was just a fluke.
Yeah, and I think you know, it sounds like you did everything that you could. The one thing that I need to ask you, though, is did you have an autopsy done?
We did not.
Okay. So whenever I have a case like this where there's a lot of unanswered questions, I do strongly recommend that an owner have an autopsy done. You can still get your pet's remains to be cremated or go home with you, but it's I think it helps with closure.
Where would you do that then? How would you
the veterinarian that you were working with could have had it done. And I mean, when I was in private practice, I would do autopsies at the owner's request, and tissue samples would be sent to the state lab, and I would, you know, try to get answers to find out what was the, you know, cause of the pet's demise. You know, at the veterinary school, we have a full pathology department, and, you know, we do that as well for clients that are using our services, and for outside people as well. Although if you're a, you know, a client at the veterinary school, we don't even charge for having an autopsy done. We feel that's how important it is for people that are coming from the outside. We do have, you know, autopsy charges, but if your pet is with us, that's, you know, we consider that part of like our you know, full care, even if it's, you know, at the end of the pet's life. So it's unfortunate, but I think there's always going to be those unanswered questions. And it sounds like you did everything you could, that your pet was in good hands at a referral center, and you made a decision that was probably, for the pet's sake, the best. And
yeah, it was. He couldn't let him go on like that. But I guess you're right. The autopsy might have answered questions for the future for us, too, like in another pet, what may have happened. Maybe we did do something, you know. I mean,
It's very unlikely that it was anything that you did, but, you know, it's just, you know, one of those things where, you know, bad things happen to nice pets sometimes, and I wish I could stop all the badness, but sometimes we can't. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for calling. I'm kind of tearing up because I'm thinking about one of my own. I'm thinking about Candace's pet, but I'm also thinking about one of our pets too. That
I know,
Frosty. That
You know, and it's always hard. Pet loss. I mean, they are family members, and I think this owner might want to consider looking at, you know, does her local shelter offer, you know, pet support. Pet loss support groups. Mm-hmm. I know we have that going on locally here, and it's always helpful to be able to talk with somebody and other people that are going through this and, you know, just to kind of wrap their head around, you know, I think she's feeling very guilty and that's part of
she shouldn't.
Yeah, but it's part of the normal grieving process as well.
Thank you again, Candace, for calling. I'm sorry for your loss. Let's turn to Brianna in Black Earth next. Brianna, hello to you.
Hello. Dr. Sandy,
yes.
I have a question for you. Several callers ago, you commented somebody had a dog with a injured paw, and you said licking was bad for, you know, that their mouth was full of germs. Years ago, when I was a kid, this is like 60 years ago, we, of course, didn't have a lot of money. My dog disappeared, my dearly beloved dog, disappeared one day and didn't come home for 3 days, and we really wondered, oh, what's happened?
Right.
Finally, at the end of 3 days, he did come home. I can't remember if he was covered with ants or if we surmised, but anyhow, he had a hole in his sort of his side and his groin, 4 inches in diameter.
Oh my goodness!
And the intestines were, you know, it was through the intestinal wall.
Oh my goodness!
And we took a look at this, and my father, who had grown up in South Dakota on a ranch, said, well, either he'll live or he'll die.
Yeah.
And just leave him alone. And so he lay down and pretty much didn't move for some period of time. He ate and drank and licked that wound constantly.
Yeah.
By the time he came home, it was totally clean. So we thought he maybe had, you know, the ants had cleaned it up. I mean, it was just a round circular hole, totally clean. And I was just amazed. I wondered how, if you have any evidence, you know, any knowledge nowadays, being a vet and treating animals, animals in the wild left alone. Anyhow, this hole, you know, by the day, you could see it shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink.
Well, it was granulating in, and that's what we, you know, when they shrink like that, it was scarring in and healing. And your dog was very lucky to be able to survive an open abdominal injury like that. Most, you know, dogs will end up getting peritonitis and dying from an injury like that. What happens when dogs lick, besides the bacteria being transferred from their mouth, I mean, my dogs, you know, they drink out of the toilet, they eat things they shouldn't, and you don't want that kind of stuff in a wound. And so, you know, it's not good to do that, but also just the activity of the enzymes and so on in the dog's mouth, and the action of the tongue is going to be sweeping away those developing healing cells that are trying to close that wound. So it can take longer for a wound to heal if you're continually taking those cells away. So you had a case where your dog did okay, but boy, that would not have been the way I would have recommended it be treated. Thank you for the story, and it's kind of heartwarming to know that, you know, your dog survived and lived to, tell its story on public radio. But boy, you know, if any of you ever have a dog wound like that, it's an emergency. Get help right away.
All right. Thanks, Brianna, for calling. I appreciate your call. We had an email from Paul, who's found a product at Walgreens called New Skin. It worked great for healing a dog pad. No licking and applied a few times a day, always healed.
Yeah, that's a liquid bandage, and we use those. I mean, I use it on myself if I've got an abrasion or something like that. And that might be something you can try. But again, you don't want the. It depends on how deep the pad wound is. Sometimes we'll just get dogs that are kind of road warriors and they just wear their pads out. I had one of the local police dogs in that was doing some apprehension work and skidded on the pavement and just took the top surface of all its pads off.
Oh.
And that what must have been so painful. Imagine having your heels down to raw tissue and then having to walk on it. That was the case where we had to keep them covered, and they were deep enough that using something like New Skin on an abrasion like that probably wouldn't have helped a whole lot, but keeping them covered did. So if it's very superficial, that might be something to try.
How do you keep a dog off its feet, though, the police dog?
We had to. He was like out off duty for a little bit, and with all the bandages on his feet, he was. We had to wait until everything healed up and was back to being normal again. It took weeks.
And the address or email of for those who want to get that. Story, that article that you had about food.
I have, it's from one of my textbooks that I use at work.
Oh.
And if they would like to, I think my email address is actually on the website.
Yes.
They can email me and I would be more than willing to, it'd be much easier if I have a fax number. And if you have a fax, I'd be glad to fax something to you.
All right. Thanks very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Kathy in Spring Green's been waiting quite a while here, so we're going to go right to the phones and to Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We just adopted a one-year-old Shih Tzu poodle mix.
Mm-hmm.
And she's crate trained, and we've been working on her housebreaking, using treats and positive reinforcement when she goes outside.
Good.
And she's been doing really good. She'll go a couple of weeks, and then she'll have an accident. And her accidents are like on the couch, which is her favorite place in the whole world, is to lie on the couch.
Yeah.
So we took her to the vet and found that she had a bladder infection.
Okay.
So we had her on antibiotics, and we've double-checked, and she's fine. And so we're feeling really good about that. And then she urinated on our bed.
Now, is this happening when she's laying down and sleeping? She'll just, like, dribble urine out? Or is she actually actively getting up and walking and squatting on your bed?
Well, she's done it on the bed twice. Once, we were actually looking at each other, and she was squatting.
Oh, she was?
She looked at me and went.
Okay.
And then one other time, I don't know, because I was asleep.
Okay.
Yeah.
The reason why I was asking is that sometimes female dogs will have issues with urinary incontinence, where just when they lay down and they're relaxed and some urine will dribble out and you'll get little puddles on where they're sleeping. But it sounds like if you're actually watching her, that's probably what she's doing is squatting and actually actively voiding. I would be very hesitant to be having her up on your bed. And it may be that if she can't physically get down easily, that she is kind of feels like I'm trapped up here and I have no way of notifying my family that I need to go to the bathroom outside because I haven't learned how to do that yet. So you may want to be looking at not having her in situations like that up on your bed and so on until she's nailed a really good, this is how I bark, or this is what I do when I need to go to the bathroom. And that's something that comes with time. It's one of those things that kind of happens randomly, and the dog actually trains us to respond to a certain signal that they're going to give. Make sure that the positive reinforcement that you're using, which is great, I'm glad to hear that, is occurring as soon as her fanny's coming up off the ground. You need to be outside there with her. If you wait until she comes into the house, there's no association with the behavior that you're rewarding. And so she just got rewarded for coming inside and being a cute dog in your kitchen. So reward her right outside. And I'd, you know, just be, you know, making sure that, you know, maybe she's in her crate at night, that 100% of your attention is on her. With her being a year old dog at adoption, I just wonder if she was like in a crate with blankets, and blankets equals toilet, you know? And so now she's up on your bed and, hey, you know, this is nice and absorbent. I'm going to just use this.
I would like to mention, however, that she's also going on the couch and once on the other chair in our living room. So she is able to easily get on and off these pieces of furniture other than the bed.
Okay. And again, I would not be letting her until she is reliably housebroken have freedom in the house. So that if you are, you know, if you can't be watching her, she's in her crate. Or a nice thing that I like to do is actually put a leash on them and hook them to your belt. That I call that the umbilical cord method of training. Very difficult for a dog to have an accident unless it's on your shoes. So you know exactly who has to clean it up. That way the dog is going to start to get a little anxious, and when she has to go, and you're right there to be able to get her outside. And you are right there to be right with her so that as soon as her fanny's coming up off the ground, you can get that reward into her. So I think we're giving her a little more freedom than she deserves. So I'm glad you've ruled out medical problems, but I think keep up with the crating and leashing.
Can I ask you, how long would you do that for until you start to give her a little bit more freedom?
I would say until she's reliably, which would mean like a good month or so of having no accidents at all in the house. And that she is starting to be able to give you a signal that she needs to go, whether it be ringing a bell, which some people like, or barking, going to the door and barking, whimpering at the door, you know, heading right to the door. And, you know, as soon as you open it, out she goes and goes to the bathroom. So, at least a month. Yeah.
Okay. Here's another. And thanks, Kathy, by the way, for calling. Another Catherine called or emailed us, I should say, who has even a worse problem in terms of her dog. Her dog pees on everything she may be standing on. She's messed up a couple of couches. She gets excited. She pees when I come home from work. She pees when she sees me. I just come in from outside. If I reach to pet her, she drops and pees.
Oh, my goodness.
She's about a year old and maybe a little bit more, but she chews everything. She's making me nuts as well.
Okay. Sounds like we've got lots of behavior issues going on here, but the chewing and so on. But to address the elimination, this is most likely just what we call a submissive wetter. When the dog squats, when you're greeting them, leaning over her, saying hello to her, sometimes like dogs when they're excited or a little nervous, they'll just, squat and pee. So you need to boost her confidence, which means maybe squatting down, getting at her level to say hello, not giving her direct eye stares, making sure you do most of your greetings outside. Remember, this is almost an involuntary type response for the dog, and so no punishment. That's just going to make this worse as well. So if you are punishing her, stop right away. But ask your veterinarian about tips for dealing with submissive urination, and you may even find some things that you can find in some behavior books and so on that. But it can be managed. It's mainly changing the owner's behavior and not the dog's behavior.
A caller asks whether you can use glucosamine chondroitin for a pet.
Yeah, they have various products on the market that are actually veterinarian related products. You can also use sometimes some of the human products that are out there. It's one of those what are classified as a nutraceutical. And I went to a talk one time, and I just remember the person saying that there is more glucosamine chondroitin sulfate sold in the United States than manufactured, which means that there's probably some filler and different things in there that you may not be getting what you're actually actually hoping to have your dog on. We use it for joint support. So for dogs that have had joint surgery done, elderly dogs that maybe are a little arthritic. There are many foods, especially for large breed dogs that have some glucosamine and chondroitin sulfate already in it, may not be at therapeutic levels. And so, again, this would be something to speak to your veterinarian about, a brand that they would recommend. My favorite one to use is a brand called Cosequin, and that's the veterinary version of a glucosamine chondroitin sulfate that a company called Nutramax makes. They make a human product called Cosamin, so people that are on that, that may be what you're taking. So it just happens to be beef-flavored, chewable-type tablets. So.
And I know for people, we were just talking about this yesterday on the program with people, it takes about 3 months before mm-hmm. you see any results. Would
right.
that be the same for...
It does. It's a long-term thing, and you almost just have to believe that it may help. And there's been very few controlled studies for dogs. So, you know, it won't hurt them, so why not use it?
Barbara in Wausau, your turn now. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
What can we do for you?
I have a almost 2-year-old Bichon poodle, and she, no matter what we have done, she'll get in the bathroom and pull Kleenex and, you know, the fanny wipes she uses and everything out of the waste basket, chew them up, eat them, drag them all over the house.
Oh, and, so much fun.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying to break her of this habit.
Yeah. Well, a few things you may want to do. Number one is changing your behavior. Put the waste basket in your cabinet. Get a waste basket with a lid on it, so that she
can,
okay. And you know, sometimes we even have to go as far as booby trapping the waste basket. And I like to use either mouse traps set upside down, so that when she goes to pull the Kleenex off out of it, it triggers it off. So you have to, you know, very carefully put a mouse trap upside down in there, and that may help. There is a product on the market. You can go online and get them. They're called Jumpo. It's a kind of a plastic device with bungee cords. Might be a little cumbersome to set up in a waste basket type situation, but it's just, if you've got cats that are getting up on the counter, or, you know, pets that are getting into areas, all you have to do is nudge this thing and it snaps and flies in the air, and it's not going to pinch feet. But, you know, it does make a pretty scary sound. Makes me jump when I have it go off. So I have one at work and show owners that. But that might be something you'd want to be looking into. But, yeah, I'd try booby trapping. But also be looking at what else can she be playing with. If she's doing this kind of activity, does she have other toys, things around the house that are as equally attractive? And you may have to, you know, head back to the pet store and find things that she likes to chew on, and provide her with lots of outlets for her activity.
All right.
All right. One more question, please.
Mm-hmm.
This only happens occasionally, hardly ever at home anymore. But when I'm in Wausau, when we leave, she will go up to the second floor in the house and leave us her present
okay.
up there. But, you know, it's like, okay, you've gone away. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm going to thank you with.
Well, she's probably not consciously thinking, you know, I'm going to get back at him by eliminating. If, I mean, she really wanted to get back at you, she'd steal your credit card and charge up, you know, a bunch of charges or whatever, you know. This is probably stress-related. One of the more common reasons why dogs will, when they're left alone, eliminate in the house, besides the fact that they can't get outside and they don't have access to a toilet and they've got a full bladder, is separation anxiety. And so it may be just location-specific that, you know, in some locations where you're at with her, you can come and go and she knows, yeah, you'll be home. But maybe at that place, when you say you're in Wausau and you're leaving, she doesn't quite understand that when you walk out of this house that you're going to be coming back anytime soon. And that's typically what dogs will do, is they may bark, they may howl, they may chew things up, scratch at the woodwork and so on. And sometimes they just eliminate. So no punishment when she does this, because that's just going to create a lot more stress in her life.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Michelle in Dubuque, Iowa, we are on to you now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you very much. My cat recently had her annual checkup and found that, you know, she had some tartar on her teeth and her gums were red just above the tooth line.
Uh-huh.
And so we set up an appointment to have the tartar removed and to have a biopsy of her gums.
Mm-hmm.
The vet thought that maybe it was some kind of immune response.
Right.
So, and she also had to have a tooth removed.
Okay.
Because it was rotten.
Mm-hmm.
And the biopsy results have come back, and they've said that it's a severe inflammatory something.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm not sure. So we're going to, I guess, go on some antibiotics and some steroids. Could you give me a little bit of information about what's happening here?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the diagnosis is. We can just see cats with, you know, the standard dental disease getting gingivitis. And, you know, if you clean the teeth and, you know, clean all the plaque and so on off from under the gum line, polish the teeth up, and the mouth heals up, great. But if it's really severe gingivitis, and especially if it's associated with any other plaque lesions kind of in the back of the throat area, there's a condition that cats get called LPGS, lymphocytic plasmacytic gingivitis stomatitis. Mm. And it is an immune problem, which is what your vet is probably concerned about, where the cat is trying to fight off even minuscule amounts of the normal plaque in her mouth. So, you know, when we wake up in the morning, we have that kind of fuzzy feel to our teeth. That's plaque. And we brush it and off it comes. Cats aren't brushing their teeth. And so even that little bit of plaque it's like a hypersensitivity to plaque. And so for these cats, you know, ideally you would practice extreme dental hygiene, brushing two or three times a day, using dental diets and so on to try to keep that plaque under control. There are other cases where we need to go in and actually remove all of the teeth, everything from the canine teeth back. And these cats will get dramatically better having no teeth in the back of their mouth. So it all depends on the severity of the case. Sometimes again, if the biopsy showed that it's actually a bacterial infection, which I don't know how they diagnose that, you know, maybe an antibacterial will help. That would be something you and your veterinarian need to discuss. But do some research on lymphocytic, plasmacytic, gingivitis, stomatitis in cats. And I'm sure that you'll, you know, maybe able to identify what's going on with your cat's mouth.
All right.
Okay, great.
Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. A caller has a 4-year-old cat who lays on her back with paws in the air and appears to be sleeping. Is there something to this behavior?
No, just that the cat likes to sleep on its back. I like to sleep on my stomach. I don't know. Some people like to sleep on their sides. And it's so cute to see a cat just stretch out like that. So if she's comfortable, and not having any troubles breathing, I'd say just let the sleeping cat stay there. Yeah.
Okay. I have an email from Susan who says, my orange cat, Shay, has a pea-sized, fluid-filled bump on the base of its tail on his spine. Been there for a week or so. You can move it around with your finger, but stays on the spine. Shall I take him to the vet? He's about 4.
Yeah. I mean, this may be nothing but a little cyst. It could be a little skin tumor. Could be an abscess if the cat is an indoor outdoor cat. A lot of cats that get into fights will have their rear end area bit. That's a common spot for injuries. So I think it's time to take your kitty in. What your veterinarian would probably do besides looking at your cat, measuring how big this is do a needle biopsy where they put a needle in, get some of the material out of there, look at it on a slide and decide what the cause is.
Here's a bumpy, fatty bump on a dog question.
Okay.
Gladys says, I have a little dog and a bump appeared and now it has disappeared. It was a fatty bump, but he does look a little lopsided on one side where the bump was. Is this common?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes the bump will actually get bigger and it just kind of dissipates between muscle layers. Lipomas are benign fatty tumors that a lot of animals, cats and dogs, and even humans get them too. And they like to occur pretty much anywhere in the body, but prefer kind of the chest wall. So if this was diagnosed as a lipoma, wouldn't expect it to go away. But my guess is if your dog is a little asymmetrical, that it probably got a little bit bigger over time.
An email from Steph, who has a grooming business and has been grooming for 15 years. Over the years, I've gotten conflicting advice on anal glands. Should they be expressed during the grooming process, or does this just irritate them and make it worse for the dog? I was told it weakens the muscle, and over the time, the dog loses its ability to do this on its own. Almost all the small breed dogs have full glands when I check them during the bathing process.
Yeah, and that you know, that's a really controversial thing. And, of course, it happens to happen over lunch hour. You know, we have to talk about something gross. But these little anal glands sit on either side of the rectum. In dogs, they're about 4 o'clock and 8 o'clock. In cats, they're more about 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock. So cats have them as well. The difference between dogs and cats is not only the location of them, but the way the ducts sit. In dogs, the ducts point in towards the interior of the anus. In cats, they point straight back. And I've been hit in the face numerous times lifting a cat's tail up and whoosh, out comes some anal gland secretion. But for dogs, that's the problem is unless the groomer is doing it via a rectal, which I doubt, by applying pressure externally on either side, especially if there's some inflammation in the glands or the material in there is real thick, you can cause more trouble than help. So if it's real liquidy and they express easily, I have absolutely no problems with the groomer doing that. But don't apply a lot of force. And if they are full and you can't get them emptied easily, that would be the time to tell the owner when they come in to pick up their dog. You better take your dog into the vet. The anal glands are really full and they didn't empty easily when I just, you know, put some pressure on from the outside. So, you know, go in and let your veterinarian or technician do a rectal and get those things emptied out and check the contents.
Jeanette in Rubicon, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I have a mixed breed dog that I rescued from the Humane Society, and she's part Border Collie, part Australian Shepherd, and they said a little lab mixed in, although I don't see any lab in
okay.
her.
Okay.
But I heard you say something about a female dog sometimes leaks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she maybe that's what she's doing because she will develop a really bad odor back there
okay.
in the rear area, and it's hard to get rid of even with I can't breathe her all the time. She's a big, pretty good sized dog, 70
yeah.
pounds.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the two things that I would be thinking of is anal glands, which we just talked about, because that produces a very foul-smelling odor, and it's kind of metallic-y, very gross smell. The other thing would be is if she's getting some urine scalding, and if you've got more of an ammonia-type smell, it may be that she is leaking a little bit of urine, or if she's overweight, depending on how her...
She's not overweight.
Yeah, how her vulva is positioned, how much hair is back there, she may be trapping urine. So when you do, you know, have this odor, if she will lay down and let you have a look back there. Is it wet? Is the skin irritated? And if she is leaking urine, it's something that can be treated. We use either a drug called phenylpropanolamine or PPA. It's sometimes known as Proin is one of the brand names. The other drug that we'll use is DES, which is an estrogen. And some dogs do better on that one. So we, you know, kind of flip-flop between those two.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Kelly in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Kelly.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. Good. Thank you.
Good. I have a 3-year-old male Schipperke. 3 weeks ago, he had an intestinal biopsy, and he has mild Crohn's disease.
Okay.
So I'm wondering, how should we be investigating treating this?
Well, if you already went to have a biopsy done, I think, you know, isn't the veterinarian helping you with diet and so on? Because usually we'd be putting these dogs on a hypoallergenic diet, something like ZD or HA that Nestle Purina makes. The other thing that we might be looking at is either a type of steroid. Sometimes we'll use steroids short term. Sometimes a drug called budesonide helps some of these dogs that may be steroid intolerant. Sometimes we'll even use something like cyclosporine. There's various combinations of drugs that we use. But I think that if you've got the biopsy report, it's time to go back to the veterinarian and they know the severity and they'd be able to help you with whether drug therapy is needed on top of dietary management.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Boy, we went through lots of
calls.
And again, your email address is on our website.
It is. It's a little complicated because it's the vet school email address. So it's sawchucks@svm.vetmed.wisc.edu. So look it up on the WPR site. Yeah.
The Wisconsin Public Radio website has that. And so go to that and get Sandy's email address. And if you have a fax, it's best if you
do it. A little bit easier to do it that way.
A little bit easier to do it that way, but she will take care of it. And you will be returning
on
the 15th of September.
I will be here.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Appreciate it very much. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Sorry we didn't get to so lots of my emails we didn't make it to, and lots of phone calls as well. But we will do the best we can the next time she's on. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Just to take a look at what's coming up tomorrow, at 11, we'll take a look at the future of passenger rail service in Wisconsin. Bill Draves comes by to talk about that. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about county land preservation. Kurt Calkins of Columbia County, Mary Jo Gingras of Iron County Land Preservation will be our guests. And we have something on our community of listeners about that, too. So go to that as well. Stay with us. Lots in store.